Hey, Mindy. What's up?
Hey, I really want to make a movie.
Yeah? Okay. How are we going to do that?
I've got an iPhone. I've got three friends who kind of listen to me. And from Halloween, I've got some leftover makeup and fake blood.
Okay. Where are we going to shoot it?
The basement of my apartment building is really creepy. We could film it there.
All right. So we have a location. We've got a cast and equipment. What else do we need?
Well, what's the story going to be? Story going to be.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are the Rance Macabre.
On this episode, we're going to be focusing on the new guard, horror movies Young Turks, the indie filmmakers who've applied the DIY model to scaring and thrilling you.
But we're not just going to focus on what I like to call hipster horror or what other people call mumblegore. For context, we're also going to discuss indie horror at its roots from some of the greats, from John Carpenter, Tobe Hooper, and Sam Raimi.
One of my favorite things about young filmmakers is the sort of energy that you don't get otherwise, whereas like a Spielberg or sort of old guard, Everything's very plotted and there's a sort of calculated energy, whereas some of the newer filmmakers, you can feel there's like a kinetic energy to what they're making, and sometimes it's literally the camera moving.
Yes, unnecessarily. A lot of times.
However, with that young energy, you sometimes get misfires and the idea of a filmmaker who's thinking, okay, ready, shoot, aim.
Yes.
And so it can go off track. Sometimes you get some pretty bizarre first projects out the gate.
Bad continuity is a big one.
Yeah. Often, especially in young filmmakers, the impulse of, I just want to make a movie, is more likely than the idea of, I have this great story I need to tell.
Right.
Because they're generally young and without a lot of experience, they run into the sort of pitfall of the advice that they give writers, like, write what you know. It's like, okay, well, I'm 18.
What do I know at 19 years old?
I grew up in the suburbs. What do I know? I spit at cop cars.
I drink beer in the woods.
So thank God they have more imagination than that. So film is a fascinating medium because of how much of a group activity it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is no one person who's ever shot a movie, done the sound, done the music, done the directing, done the producing, acted in it. Like you'd get very few of those.
Right.
If any. Because film requires so many people to engage, It varies from most other art. And I was comparing it to music is the nearest thing I can think of, where you could be a single person in a room writing a song, and when you're done, you're done. You never had to engage another person.
Right.
And at the same time, when you're a young musician, you can hide behind metaphors. You can sort of obscure different ideas, but with film, we have to look at something.
Mm-hmm.
And because music is rarely literal, whereas films, the recurring mantra is show, don't tell.
Right.
And so that'll present a problem when you want to do something fantastical or something violent that you're going to need help doing. Because there are no filmmaker one-man armies. You get close.
Right.
And we'll talk about that. But it's always going to take help. And some of the pairings are some of my favorite elements. So why don't we jump into the new school, the Mumblegore group? I'm starting with Adam Wingard and E.L. Katz.
Now, these are the guys, these Mumblegore, what I call hipster horror, to me are the only guys making, outside of Spanish film, these guys are the only guys making good horror right now.
Yeah, sort of challenging norms, definitely.
I would say they're the only ones doing a really good job of it.
Yeah, so both these guys are from Florida and
Wingard's from Tennessee originally.
Okay.
Then he goes to Alabama. That's where he's filming and stuff.
Okay, so when E.L. Katz joined Adam Wingard in Alabama, the idea was to make a movie. E.L. Katz comes from a writing background. Adam Wingard was a young filmmaker.
Right. So what you have to remember is that all these people are interconnected.
Right. Starting from there.
And so you always see all of their names in each other's work. So then they start filming this Homesick film.
Yeah, that E.L. Katz wrote, and they sort of, by sheer will, they're like calling distributors, trying to get money. They're calling actors, flying them in. They have
19.
No job, so they obsess. Like this right. becomes their day job, except the movie turns out terrible.
Oh, wah, wah.
Yeah. And at that age, they weren't really taken seriously by the elder actors involved. So they talk about the movie, you know, in a very mature way where they recognize that, like, it's terrible, but we learned a shitload.
Sure they did. And worth mentioning, though, with Homesick is Scream Queen Tiffany Shepis, who's like a lady Kane Hodder. She's in all the kind of garbagey films, but she's got 115 credits, every single one horror.
I think it speaks to the idea that they pursued her. Like, she didn't show up by chance. They knew her. They're both like movie obsessives, so they went after her and got her. She was probably thrilled to get the phone call.
Exactly.
So that idea, Wingard, it comes up time and again, his sort of change of venue in terms of genre. Mm-hmm. So his sort of movie obsession, you see elements. Most recently, I saw The Guest, which is John Carpenter top to bottom. And the movie speaks of that because the movie is one part Terminator, one part Michael Myers, Halloween, but all sort of couched in this. You're not sure where this is going. All you know is it's ominous and it's not going to end well.
Mm-hmm.
So not giving any spoilers away, it's intense. I wouldn't label it horror, but it sort of speaks to his like movie obsession. And certainly he was going for a John Carpenter vibe.
He's one of those guys who I think is a fan.
Oh yeah.
And so then he makes like, here's for you other fans, enjoy this. And I think, I don't know when you first started hearing about him, but when I really started to notice him was in ABCs of Death, and he drew the letter Q, which is the shittiest letter to get. And he did a great, fun movie for ABCs of Death 1.
That stood out as both like really clever and funny.
Yeah, and it made me kind of notice his name.
Mm. And it turns out, by that point, had you already seen a bunch of his stuff? Because I
had, and I hadn't thought of it, honestly.
Okay.
What did I see? Popskull.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think I saw Horrible Way to Die afterwards, when then I started actually seeking this guy out.
Okay. And was your A.J. Bowen obsession established then?
So my A.J. Bowen obsession started with The Signal. Because The Signal is my all-time favorite horror movie, top to bottom. I love that movie, especially the middle. But that's when I started following A.J. Bowen. And then I would go and see, what movies is he in? And that's how I discovered Joe Swanberg. That's how I discovered everyone else.
Yeah.
Is A.J. Bowen.
It's funny. We rarely go to the movies together, but that was one of the instances where we weren't entirely sure what we were getting into.
Oh, I had no clue.
And then this movie kind of blew us away. And so for those that aren't familiar with it, The Signal is three different directors, and the tone changes dramatically between the pieces. However, it holds together really well.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like the middle act is a black comedy that is deeply dark hole black.
It's my favorite thing ever. I love that
and
middle
AJ
thing.
AJ Bowen sells it.
Yeah, AJ Bowen is amazing in it. And that's written or directed by Jacob Gentry. That's one of his. So, and again, it's just all these names you just keep hearing because, and I made a handy chart, but it's so interwoven and it's just the most confusing thing. It's very incestuous, these guys.
Mindy's going to post that on our Twitter page.
Enjoy that.
Because it really does look like a Venn diagram gone mad. but it speaks to the interconnectedness of all these filmmakers. So all these guys are indie guys who often, well, they all started their career sort of independently and then went on press tours and festival tours. Mm-hmm. The articles that I've read sounded like karaoke and drinking played a huge part in these guys connecting and even selling their movies. So all these guys sort of being like-minded movie nerds and meeting at festivals with movies that have a surprising amount in common, they sort of connect. And at that point, they are like attached at the hip, a lot of these guys, and especially writing duos.
Right. So Adam Wingard starts working with Simon Barrett. Mm. And I think probably that's probably when you think of Adam Wingard, you think of him with Simon Barrett.
Yeah, it seems
you
like
don't necessarily
couple...
think E.L. Katz, you know, with him.
Right.
So your next was Simon Barrett Wingard film, the VHS film, and the I think he did Q with Barrett. I think Barrett wrote that one.
Okay, and they did The Guest. Mm-hmm. Barrett also did A Horrible Way to Die.
Yes.
Yeah. So Simon Barrett's done a bunch of writing and sort of in and out of Hollywood, but it seems like he's had the most personal success as far as like what he sounds satisfied to do is to work on these independent movies where mm-hmm. you don't have a studio telling you this has got to fulfill the four quadrants. You've got to make, you know, old women in the Midwest happy.
Right. Right.
But that speaks to these guys and the sort of liberty that they have working outside of the system where they don't have someone looking over their shoulder. If anything, they've got someone looking over their shoulder and going, good job. That was some fucked up. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Right.
Way to go.
Right.
And so they get, you know, whatever micro budget they need to make a movie.
Those films end up becoming shorts in VHS or then long films in film festivals such as the After Dark Horror Fest, which originally was 8 Films to Die For.
Okay.
And then that's also another way that I found a lot of these guys, not particularly Adam Wingard or Ty West, but some of your fringe guys, your McQuaids and things like that. So
the newer trend of these anthology movies sort of gives a new opportunity for new names to showcase. So now the guys
Absolutely.
We're talking about are established, mm-hmm. but we keep getting glimpses at newer guys. Like we talked about the filmmaker who made Z is for Zygote, Chris Nash, mm-hmm. who I hadn't seen anything from him, and apparently comes from a special effects background. And where would he have gotten an opportunity to make that weirdness and have it seen?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And that's how E.L. Katz, I never thought of E.L. Katz, and that's not to be like, oh. Well,
he was primarily a writer up until A.
Right.
In ABCs of Horror 2.
Right, and so I said, oh my God, I loved A. I thought it was excellent. I thought it was funny.
I can't wait for you to see Cheap Thrills.
Good, because then I start doing research for the show, and I go, oh, he's involved with Adam Wingard. These guys are all made my chart very messy.
So E.L. Katz, we know him from starting with Adam Wingard. However, mm-hmm. he sounds like one of these guys who had enough success to get to Hollywood and start getting jobs and pitching shows, movies, animated projects, and is just kind of frustrated by the rigmarole of the studio process and mm-hmm. notes and things that never get off the ground. He had a project with Sam Raimi that never really took off. So he's unaccredited for all these projects and, you know, his friends are making movies. They're not
right.
waiting for some studio exec to greenlight. So he finally, I think his wife had encouraged him. It's like, you don't need that much money to make a movie. Let's find $200,000 and make a goddamn movie.
Right.
So he takes on the project to both write and direct. And for $200,000, they make Cheap Thrills with Pat Healy, who we know from The Innkeepers,
right.
which is Ty West. Also, Sarah Paxton. You were saying he essentially went to Ty West and said, could I borrow your cast?
Can I have these two people? Thank you very much.
But huge notables are also Ethan Embry and David Koechner. Ethan Embry, I didn't recognize for the first 35 minutes of the movie because he's not the can't hardly wait, like Aww. Innocent teen and that thing you do. He's not that guy anymore. He's got some heft. Like he's
he shows
got
up in
gravitas.
The strangest places nowadays, too. Every now and then he'll show up on a TV show.
He's in a small role in The Guest.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so David Koechner, who might in more roles be like too big and just sort of take you out of it.
Uh-huh.
But he is just on the mark for playing like a rich borderline sociopath high on cocaine.
Nice.
But that said, Cheap Thrills is a black comedy with only horror elements. That said, for $200,000, it's a great-looking movie. And you never once doubt that, like, he didn't make exactly the movie he wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most impressive element about it. That, like, the movie starts off solid and just gets more and more fucked up, but and you never get taken out of it.
Sure, sure. And I think that's a great transition, though, into Ty West, because you talk about taking a movie out of someone's hands.
Oh, yeah.
Now you have Cabin Fever 2, and Ty West is involved with that one.
Yeah, I guess he had made a couple smaller movies, enough to, like, gain the attention of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And so his studio says, here, we've got a franchise. We want you to keep going.
And he probably says, taking up after Eli Roth, awesome. Because, I mean, think about the time. I think he would say that it was like 2006 or something. I don't know.
I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I didn't walk away from Cabin Fever thinking, I need more of that.
Well, we'll talk about that later.
But so Ty West makes for the studio Cabin Fever 2, and I'm fascinated by what he had in mind.
Okay, Cabin Fever 2. It's a downer. I got that job. I wrote the script. I was very happy with the script. I was very happy with the cast. I was very happy with everyone. We all went to North Carolina. We made the movie. And much like the gentleman over there said, it was a very Paul Bartel type movie. It was a lot like a Joe Dante movie, like Rock and Roll High School or something like that. But it had a very Todd Solondz, John Waters vibe. It was a really outrageous comedy that was disgusting. In the same way that Evil Dead 2 or Brain Dead or Dead Alive, whatever you want to call it. It was just a really gross movie. People projectile vomiting blood 50 feet in the air and full frontal discharging male nudity, and it was really weird. And everyone was on board with it. And then we've edited the movie, and it was almost being done edited, and we showed it to Lionsgate, and they didn't like it. And they wanted to get a new editor, which is like, okay, shit happens. But what happened was they didn't get a new editor for 5 months. And in that 5 months, nothing happened. And while nothing was happening, I got money to make this movie. And I was like, shit, I think this movie's dead. So I went and made this movie. Exactly perfectly when I went to make this movie, they decided that was the time to re-edit. So what they did was they hired another editor without me. And they completely re-edited the movie from scratch without me. And this is not demonizing Lionsgate, because it's not just them. It wasn't like they were some evil conglomerate. This is just how it went down. So I went off to make this movie, came back, and they re-edited the movie from scratch. And it's terrible. And it was like a huge bummer. And it was a very sort of Hollywood cliche story of like, the movie got taken away from you and that happened. So I came back and said, well, can we work with it, try to fix it? And the answer was no. This is the movie that we're gonna deal with. And they cut it so short that it wasn't even releasable. So they were gonna reshoot new stuff that I was not necessarily gonna be involved with. I also apparently am a very difficult person. So this was like, this was like kind of like, whoa, to me. But then the movie, nothing happened again because they had some financial problems. So I edited this film, and when this film was done being edited, I popped back in and was like, what's the deal? And they're like, well, we're sticking with the cut that we have, and that's that. We want you to be involved, but you can't really do anything. So I quit, which is an extremely difficult decision. But there's nothing I could do about it. I couldn't stand by the movie at all, and I didn't like any of the people that were working with it, and I just felt it was better that if that's what they're trying to do and just finish it on their own, I'm just standing in their way. So I quit the movie. And a year later, I think they finished it. I think they finished it like 2 months ago. I don't know what's going on with it right now. I was interested in trying to get the Alan Smithy credit, but they don't let you do that anymore, which would have been some kind of silver lining to at least have that charm to it. But unfortunately, yeah, no. I mean, if you like the movie, great, but I can't give me any credit for it. And if you don't like the movie, don't blame me either. It's still very gross. I can't imagine not being really disgusting. But I don't think the humor works. It's like if you take a movie like, if you've all seen Happiness or a movie like that, there's a very fine line of humor that if someone else made that movie, it's just not going to work. And that's how I feel about Cabin Fever 2. It was a very crazy movie. It had heart wipes and star wipes, and it was a bizarre comedy. And they tried to get away from that, and I don't think it was successful. So that's my sort of Hollywood cliche story.
It reminded me of a story that I just listened to Sam Raimi tell on the Nerdist podcast.
After that, we made a terrible movie that was butchered by the studios called Crime Wave.
I liked Crime Wave.
They wouldn't let me star Bruce Campbell a couple weeks before it started to shoot. They changed the music and they re-edited the whole thing. It was really unpleasant. But we said the only movie we liked making was Evil Dead, because we had complete control. So we went to Dino De Laurentiis and said, will you give us the money to make a sequel? And he said he would. So it was really no one else probably wanted us to make a movie for them after that, after we made that terrible Crime Wave.
But with Crime Wave, what kind of a learning experience was that in terms of like how the film business works? Like, oh, what do you mean you can just take it and do whatever you want?
I guess I must have known that, but I didn't really think anyone would do that, because I've always worked with people that have respect for the director and they're finishing the movie. And I thought it might happen, but I thought at least I'd finish the movie first. But right after we were done shooting, in the midst of like 2 weeks of editing, they took the movie away.
Mm. Oh my God.
It was really weird. Well, we went off to college for like a year and a half, and I started to show the movies for money. And then we realized, hey, we're actually making more money showing our movies to the college kids than we are being a projectionist or a cab driver or whatever our other jobs were. So we said, let's see if we can't make a living doing this and drop out of school, see if we can't find dentists and doctors and raise money from them to make our first feature film. So my partner said, okay, but you can't be making these comedies you make. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, I looked out at the movies that are made for like less than $100,000 or $200,000. They're all horror movies. There's no, like, back then there was no independent scene. So he said, can you make a horror movie? I said, I don't really like horror movies. He said, well, it doesn't matter what you like. You're going to go, this is my partner, Rob Tappert, my roommate. He said, we're going to go see a horror movie, and you tell me if you can make a movie that good. So he went to go see this movie, and the audience was screaming, and they loved it. And he goes, can you make a movie that good? And I said, no, I cannot make a movie that good. I had no idea horror movies were so good. I hadn't seen them because they always scared me too much. That was Halloween that we saw. But then I started to see other horror films, and unlike most artists who are inspired by works of greatness, I was inspired every time I saw a bad horror movie, because I'd say to him, I can make a movie that bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
You just needed your bar lowered.
Yeah. It's so funny how that worked for me, but every bad movie I saw gave me confidence and sent me forward, believing that I could actually do it.
And so did you sort of model, were you like, oh, there's something sort of ironically funny about a bad horror movie, like a really inexpensive horror movie? Was that, were you sort of inspired by that?
No, not really. That I would more sit through them and think, God, there's so many bad parts. I got to remember not to shoot the bad parts and just shoot the good parts. I like this. The audience is screaming here. Yeah, there's blood and gore. There's real suspense, but this talking business. Nobody in all the movies that I went to go see that year, and I saw like 20 drive-in movies or in the theaters, no one cared about the characters. The writers didn't, for starters. And therefore, the audience didn't. There was no investment in them. So I just thought, I'm not going to spend a lot of time creating characters that nobody cares about. I'm just going to deliver the good stuff. So the thrills, the chills, the outrageous visuals, cool camera shots. And that's really how we approached Evil Dead.
I have seen the dark shadows moving in the woods, and I have no doubt that whatever I have resurrected through this book is sure to come calling for me. I fear that the only way to stop those possessed by the spirits of the book is through the act of bodily dismemberment.
So we went down to Tennessee because they had a film commission. They sent us pictures of cabins and a bridge that we could destroy that was part of something that the script required. And we went down there, and they said, you could rent this cabin or this cabin, and here's two different bridges that are abandoned that the Department of Transportation or of the state of Tennessee, I don't know what they're called, would let you destroy.
Wow.
So it's great. We'll be there in a minute.
Wow.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. What part of Tennessee were you guys in?
A city called Morristown, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little cabin in the woods there that they let us, at the time, all these steers had broken into, or using it as like a barn, but we cleaned it up and made that the cabin in the story.
Oh, wow. And then as you were making it, what did it feel like as you were making it? Did it feel like, oh, we're making something that looks completely different than anything else?
It was more like trying to survive. We didn't have any money. We barely were eating. We'd work like 16, 17 hour days. And then somebody stole some of our power tools from the place. So one of us always had to sleep there. And this is a cabin in the middle of the woods with nobody else around. And one time I was sleeping there guarding the cabin at night. And I woke up and there was a man sleeping next to me.
Oh, God.
I thought, what the hell? Who are you? And it was just like some guy from Tennessee that wandered in out of the cold, warming himself up by the fire. And he's a moonshine salesman. I thought, my God, this guy could have killed me in my sleep. You know, is this the weird? It was a weird town, weird time and place.
Or was he ever there at all? It's weird when you're making a horror movie and you wake up and a guy's just next to you.
Like, yeah, that's freaky.
You were already sort of freaked out.
After that, I would sleep on the hill. I didn't want to sleep in the cabin anymore. And the hill was a cemetery in the movie. So it was a really weird. It was less freaky for me to sleep up there than in that cabin. After that.
So then, when you made this movie and then you released it and then what happens? Like, does anything immediately happen, or is it like, oh, I guess back to make another thing?
We made the movie and we took it around to every distributor. We'd show it to them. We'd rent a screening room. And they all said, no, absolutely not. You're out of your mind. You know, this movie is awful. And we went to every single movie company in Hollywood in New York, and they all said no. And we were starting to get a little scared. And at the time, we didn't even know very much about the foreign market, but a foreign sales agent by the name of Irvin Shapiro saw the film. This guy was about 85 years old. And we said, well, did you love it? He said, it ain't Gone with the Wind, but I think I can make some money with it. So he took it to the Cannes Film Festival, which the real importance with independent people is independent filmmakers. It's really the Cannes market. That's the importance in the business. And a good sales agent like Irvin knew that Italy had 72 theaters that would show this type of unrated horror film, or that France would show it only in 25, or that Germany would ban it. So he knew the value of a or lack of value of a film like this in each of the different markets.
I think that speaks to the idea of these guys, the Mumblegore, the hipster horror crew, knowing their audience better than the studio does these days. Mm-hmm. Like, they've sort of got their ear to the ground. And so when it comes to, like, advertising the movie, or, you know, not being shy about digital distribution, mm-hmm. and, you know, making sure these things get up on Netflix first, you know, as soon as they can, or even, you know, selling it on iTunes right. simultaneously mm-hmm. during the theater release. So from the marketing end, I think it's kind of fascinating that the indie guys have so much more of a leg up in terms of creative outlets mm-hmm. where... Even going back to the Blair Witch.
Right, right.
Which in its day, the idea that they would put out a false documentary to support the storyline of a feature film.
Is excellent.
They
excellent.
Conned the country, although you weren't conned.
No, because, Eduardo Sanchez, because living in the Midwest, we had a restaurant called Steak and Shake. It's an excellent chain. Everyone should eat there.
This episode is sponsored by Steak and Shake.
Exactly. I wish I could be paid in hamburgers, whatever. Steak burgers actually is what they're called. Anyway, tangent. In the Midwest, we knew that everyone was okay because the lead actress in Blair Witch actually was in commercials for Steak and Shake, like active commercials. Oh, because Steak and Shake would produce new ones.
Right. You would see a commercial for this found footage movie about these kids that were never heard from again.
Right next to it, she's selling you milkshakes. So she's crying with snot running down her nose. And then the next thing, she's like, side-by-side milkshake.
That's awesome.
And I just want to apologize to Mike's mom and Josh's mom and my mom. I am so, so sorry. Because it is my fault. Because it was my project.
So it speaks to the viral marketing idea. And I think it's especially cool that, say, like the VHS series, but the newest one is VHS Viral.
Yes.
Which, okay, you're saying because you didn't
like it. It was terrible. It was really bad. And I love short film, and I love... I love the first two VHS, and I love the first ABC's.
Those were strong showings from Wingard.
Yes. You had your heavy hitters in the first VHS, and even in VHS 2, you had, you know, Joe Swanberg. You had everyone who's involved in this, and then VHS Viral was terrible.
One of my favorite elements that is a consistent theme between all these guys and indie filmmakers in general is the jack of all trades dynamic, where when you're starting with a small production, everybody's got six jobs that they got to do, mm-hmm. and they might only get credit for one or two. I think the most common is writer, director.
Sure.
But that said, like there, some of these guys come from backgrounds and special effects. I really dug the idea that Tobe Hooper, who made Texas Chainsaw Massacre, was a documentarian.
Like, right, right.
There's a reason that movie feels real.
It's great. That's a great looking film.
Sally, I hear something. Stop! Stop!
This is the movie that is just as real. Just as close.
Crazy! You gotta make us stop!
Just as terrifying as being there.
Please.
Even if one of them survives, what will be left? The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. After you stop screaming, you'll start talking about it.
There's something that stays with me and as far as the movie, like it is immediate. It feels like it's happening to you, mm-hmm. or like this is a live feed. This is a documentary that you're just peeking over their shoulder as it goes.
I think it's one of those films that if you would say film evolves like people, what evolved from that is something POV horror.
Mm.
Because you feel like someone's following the scene with a handheld camera. And I think that eventually is what becomes then handheld POV.
That's a really interesting idea. It does feel like this is happening to you. I think that's the scariest element of it.
Yeah.
There's actually very little on-camera violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, for a movie called Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's not that gory, but it was, I think it was released unrated because mm-hmm. they wanted to give it an X.
The remake was very gory, in contrast, and a shittier movie also in contrast.
It speaks to the new idea of don't hold anything back, just mm-hmm. show. If there's going to be mm-hmm. ultra violence, then show it. But Tobe Hooper is really clever about like using shadows and sort of these suggestive violent moments. And sometimes that is way more visceral.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about the idea that like it feels like a POV horror movie. It feels like it's happening to you. And like what person, when they're being chased by a chainsaw wielding maniac, like hangs around to see what's going to happen to their friends. No, you see a glimpse of it because your back is turning. You're falling.
You started running.
Yeah.
You'll probably trip over a log and fall.
So in digging around, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre had a hard time getting marketed here in the States. It had a hard time with the rating, despite it not being actually that violent. But it was banned in the UK. So was Evil Dead and Cannibal Holocaust. But I think a lot of these movies, the like sort of founding fathers of these indie horror movies, mm-hmm. these like drive-in horror movies, I think in the long run, certainly for their longevity, a number of these, it worked for them to get banned.
Absolutely. You have, in 71, Kubrick has Clockwork banned in the UK, and it's a huge success.
I think it's kind of a really fun element of the moment you ban something, people start, their ears perk up, and they're like, what is about this movie that I'm not allowed to watch? And it sort of speaks to that, like, kid who, you know, might get wind of this thing that they're mm-hmm. not allowed to see, they're not allowed to hear, and so they chase it down, and they might be too young to even see it. You know, it's the whole idea behind rating systems. But,
sure, sure.
I think it helps the sort of classic status that these people dig up and, like, have a relationship with this movie.
And I think that's a great thing to think about for marketing for horror, especially these independent guys. This is how they get word around. It's banned in the UK. That's the best thing you could get, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, you think about even just how we share film, you know, bootleg sometimes, because you can't get it. You can't find these things.
Yeah.
And so I think like these guys, they excel and succeed in their films by how they market it and knowing they're horror fan.
I think it's kind of funny when the studio has a turd. They don't screen it for critics. They mm-hmm. don't ban it. They just hold it back so that they make their first weekend box office and they expect it to taper off.
Mm-hmm.
But I think someone who has a reasonable relationship with like a public consciousness knows that word of mouth is going to be your best
absolutely
means of getting the news out.
And you have the success of Saw from something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Saw was a fascinating one in the speaking to the idea of these low budget movies that, if anything, the budget goes into the marketing of it. So Saw in 2004 from the Australian filmmakers James Wan and Lee Whannell, they were trying to pitch the movie around. It gets enough attention, their short movie that they're going to use to pitch it. And the original idea was, we've got no resources, so mm-hmm. let's make a movie with two guys in one room, and what do you make out of that?
Right, right.
And so, yeah, you put a dead guy in the middle of them, and go.
And that's an excellent short. Like, that is an excellent short.
Yeah. And so with that idea that they're pitching around, it eventually gets represented in Hollywood and someone bites. But, you know, it's not a big budget movie, but realistically it wasn't made to be. And they mm-hmm. frankly probably would have ruined it if they tried to, like, make it a worldwide story or whatever it would have been with a budget. But, yeah, at the end of the day, like, the first Saw movie was made for under $1 million. It was made for $700,000, shot in 18 days, and it has Danny Glover, Cary Elwes,
right.
Tobin Bell early, and Michael Emerson, who everybody knows from Lost, and it's my favorite of the series.
Oh, of course. Saw one.
Yeah, the second was close, but I do really love the first one. Similarly, actually, John Carpenter's Halloween was made on a budget of $300,000 at the time and grossed $47 million. And that was 1978. Someone did the inflation difference, and it's the equivalent of a movie now making $250 million.
That's crazy.
To think that that's what Halloween did. But it started a genre.
Right.
Like, all of a sudden, absolutely. You've got slasher. There's no Jason. There's mm-hmm. no Friday the 13th series without Michael Myers.
Right, right.
And so John Carpenter, like, put that movie by sheer force of will. And actually, that's another one that's not especially violent. The movie, like, he also did the famous Music.
Mm-hmm.
So he's one of these guys who's like a jack of all trades, who, you know, is writing, directing, and he started a genre that, mm-hmm. and nobody wanted it. That shit kills me. That a studio was given the option. Take or leave
it. Yeah, I'd be like, eh.
They wouldn't recognize a good idea. But that's the thing. It's gotta make money for anyone to pay attention. So Wes Craven, sort of in the same camp as John Carpenter. Everybody knows him, Wes Craven, from Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream.
Right.
But he started his career in a much grittier, much more indie place.
Rough, rough film.
Here is the first motion picture to offer to the daring a look into the final maddening space between life and death. The last house on the left. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie.
Sights and sounds far beyond anything you've tested. The last house on the left. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie.
Take as only much as you can.
So, Last House on the Left in 1972 is like an early home invasion movie. He considered it, like, he used the term hardcore. Like, this is going to be a hardcore movie. And then they start making it, and he backs off a little bit. So
it's
they actually
change.
It's
hardcore.
So, it as intense as it is, it was written worse.
Well, it was written worse and grittier.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when I think that film, to me, when shit starts to hit the fan, it's excellent. It starts rolling and it really starts going. When Wes Craven's in the very beginning, the girls are talking on the rock or whatever, and they're saying things that no woman would ever say. And it's like Wes Craven said, I bet girls sit on rocks and talk about things like this.
Right.
And
it looks like a
bizarre
Summer's Eve commercial.
Yeah. It's the weirdest, most stilted, strange thing. And then when you meet the bad guys, then it starts to roll and it really starts to yeah. move along.
And they stand out as, I mean, that there's your contrast where mm-hmm. you have, like, at least what he thinks of as like young innocence.
Right, right.
And then you've got these guys who seemingly escaped from an insane asylum. So that's one that sort of pushed the boundaries of like sexual terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it was written much where they cut out from the script like a bunch of like forced lesbianism, and it would have pushed even more boundaries. It wouldn't have gotten shown in movies. You would have had to go to like a, you know, these rated X theaters.
Yeah,
to see
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
But that was another one that was made on like a micro budget, but still, I was surprised that, I liked it. I was surprised how much it held up. Like I really liked the parents. I think that was an impressive feat.
They make the film.
Yeah.
Those actors are excellent, you know, and I don't know any of these people from anything later.
Yeah, I think that's actors. One of the... So it's funny that now the Mumblegore group are... is going... Like, Your Next was like community theater.
Mm-hmm.
And you might... You know, your sort of average theater goer might not recognize everybody on screen, but, you know, those who are aware are like, okay, well, that guy's a writer. That guy's right. a director. That guy's been in all the other movies. The horror movies, I think... probably benefit the most from not knowing actors, like using new faces.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's out of necessity because they can't afford like an A-list actor. But sometimes, you know, they find themselves in AJ Bowen.
Right.
And he's someone who he doesn't have like chiseled good looks. He's kind of a bear.
He is, but I love him. And I would marry him. No, and you know, the funny thing about A.J. Bowen is sometimes he shaves his beard and then it's like, I don't know who he is.
Yeah, yeah. And
it's like
stuff.
Wearing camouflage. And I go, where'd you go? Who are you? Yeah, no, A.J. Bowen's excellent. But, you know, it reminds me, though, of Sam Raimi still using
Bruce Campbell,
using Lucy Lawless, using the same people.
Yeah. I think it lowers the stakes. It's kind of like you're watching a Law and Order episode and they're like, this week's celebrity guest casting. And like, all right, well, I could fucking guess who's going to be involved in the crime.
But I look forward to seeing A.J. Bowen, even though a lot of the times he's the shady guy.
He plays a good turn character.
Yeah, when he's not shady, I get confused a little. But I think he's an excellent actor because I love his films and I love the films he's in, but Joe Swanberg talks and A.J. Bowen listens as an actor, let's say.
Okay.
Joe Swanberg would just talk. And A.J. Bowen is the best listening actor I've ever encountered because he really listens to the scene. And that's why he's like so good.
Yeah.
He could go on forever.
I recently watched A Horrible Way to Die.
Mm-hmm.
And... it's funny, I watched it in two parts. After the first part, which was an hour and 15 minutes, I had to turn it off and go to bed, and I came into work, and I said, Mindy, that was kind of, what the hell? This is boring. And then the movie turns around incredibly.
I told you it would.
So that said, we'll talk about A Horrible Way to Die for a second. A first major outing for Adam Wingard and Simon Barrett. It has a couple of like tells as far as this is not a big production. We don't know exactly what we're doing. We have a good idea as far as what we want this to look like, but needless shaky cam, some sort of a lot of like obscured filming, not a lot of on-screen violence, but I think that actually worked out for it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of these movies I kind of love the creative element that comes with like, well, we don't have the budget to do like a straight on violent attack.
Right, right.
So like maybe you obscure it in shadow, or maybe you do it in silhouette, or, you know, you might have like an effective jump cut.
It harkens back to then Universal Monsters in that way of like, we can't show people. Like in The Black Cat, we can't show this, but we'll show the shadow of it.
The suggestive element is kind of worse. And going back to the idea of it speaks to if you were witness to this thing, would you stare it down? Would you be staring right at it?
You know that
no,
I would.
No, you'd be scared. I think you'd be running.
Oh, I'd be running for sure.
I would have the presence of mind to run away from a violent threat.
I wouldn't just stand there with my mouth open.
Wait, guys, I gotta get my phone out.
Let me videotape this.
So that said, the special effects element, where it used to be a sort of go-to where you needed your Stan Winston, you needed your Tom Savini, you needed your Greg Nicotero.
Sure.
These days, it's kind of fun to watch like the new up-and-comers. So we already talked about Chris Nash, but shows like Face Off on the Sci-Fi Network on a season-by-season basis show us that like there are tons of special effects guys who are, you know, maybe... Like, I've made my fair share of zombie makeup stuff from tutorials I found online. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you give me some fake blood and some liquid latex, and I could make a pretty decent zombie face. And I'm doing it once a year, but there are specialists out there who are, like, going the whole nine yards. And that's a lot of fun. The idea that in the same way the internet is democratizing the industry, now you don't need to have like studied under Stan Winston for 15 years to get your chance.
Right.
Yeah. I kind of love the idea that DIY has really touched every element of the film industry.
And in hipster horror, well, a lot of hipster horror is not a creature feature.
Right.
So it avoids using a huge costume or a huge latex suit, anything like that.
Yeah.
And then again, it almost cuts away. So there's a lot you don't have to waste your money and your time on as far as effects go.
Yeah. I enjoy that dynamic where the necessity being the mother of invention.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than having it like surprise you that like, hey, sorry, we lost funding or, you know, our budget got cut. They know going into it that like, okay, we've got, you know, it's your MacGyver moments. Like we got some fucking matchsticks, popsicle sticks and, you know, three pairs of shoes and let's make a monster.
Yeah.
Or, you know, not a monster, but you know, we need to do a stunt or an arrow to the head or something to that effect. But a lot of times those challenges kind of raise everyone's game. Mm-hmm. I think a huge stylistic contrast between Adam Wingard is Ty West.
But I associate them always together.
Yeah, it seems like they probably spend a lot of time together, just being in the same social circles, being in each other's movies. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So Ty West, so I mean it, but I don't mean it in that camp. I do think of him as like a young Kubrick in terms of Adam Wingard is sort of stylistically adaptable. His early stuff, you know, it seemed like a learning curve there, but Ty West has an eye for things and I couldn't really explain why his pacing works as well as it does, but what was the French word you used last episode?
Oh, mise en scène. Yeah. Mise en scène, yeah.
So composing each frame.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful.
Like a still image. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's an individual piece of art at 24 frames a second. I really love this sort of pacing of House of the Devil and Innkeeper.
I always think of House of the Devil. And even when we're talking about Wes Craven, Last House on the Left,
yeah,
it makes me think of House of the Devil because House of the Devil was so beautiful of that time period, that late 70s, early 80s. And I mean, down to the phones, down to the cars, down to the hair. Ty West made a beautiful film top to bottom from House of the Devil. I just love the look of that movie. Yeah.
You said he doesn't like the term homage.
He hates the term homage, which I didn't think it was offensive until I read that he doesn't like it because he thinks it's like it's trying to be that
like
way.
Like derivative,
and And he's saying, you know, I'm not trying to interpret this film. Like a Wes Craven. I'm not trying to be an 80s film. This is just a film that I made now that takes place in the early 80s. So it's like a period piece.
Okay.
Because you wouldn't say that something like Dangerous Liaisons is an homage to French, 1800 France, or something. So that's why he's saying it's a period piece and it should be viewed as a period piece, not an homage, which I think is interesting.
I don't know if I buy that entirely.
I don't think I like that.
Well, I think it's interesting that like Wingard will take his hat off and say like, yes, this movie influenced me this way. Mm-hmm, whereas mm-hmm. Ty West is a little more guarded. It's almost like he wants a little more credit for his own idea. But I'll give him the credit. I really liked his work. Most recently was The Sacrament, which was the Jim Jones in Guyana, right?
Yeah.
Is where the Jonestown Massacre. So that's another A.J. Bowen spectacular.
Absolutely. Joe Swanberg is there joining the party.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Amy, I always forget how to say her last name. I'm sorry. Amy Simons, I think is how you say her name. She's in all their films. She's also in The Sacrament. She's excellent.
Yeah. And the lead guy, shit, I didn't write it down, but the cult leader is extraordinary.
So his name is Gene Jones. And it really reminds me of like a Max Schreck thing, right?
Okay.
The Nosferatu Max Schreck.
Right.
You never find him again. Gene Jones, though, has been in other films billed as Gene Jones. But like, what's the freaking luck that you're playing Jim Jones? Your name is Gene Jones, and he does such an excellent job.
Yeah. And for
he's outstanding
for not an actor. And I love the idea that Ty West is really honest with these characters. And you know what? I'll go back and give him the credit for House of the Devil not being an homage. He's not casting like Hollywood actors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He is hiring a girl who looks like a college student, you know, in 1980s Michigan.
Right.
And in The Innkeepers, like, it's a very basic story. There's not a glamour to it. And in The Sacrament, the Jim Jones character
mm-hmm.
looks like someone who would absolutely need to get by on their charisma. Like, he is not a studio face.
But he does.
He holds attention, yeah.
And that's where, when you do finally have the scene, when I was talking before about A.J. Bowen being such a good listener, this Gene Jones, again, he's also a good listener. That's, to me, what makes an excellent actor.
Those interview segments were fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yes, there is, like, a sound effect, but, like, you can hear a hum. You can feel, like,
the building tension.
Yes. Yeah. Those two are excellent together.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Sacrament's still on Netflix streaming. Mm-hmm.
You gotta watch that.
For those
that.
Listening, actually, absolutely track that down. And then look into the Jonestown Massacre, because that's a real life
that's
horror story.
Horror enough, yeah.
So that one being a real departure, but still being like really earnest.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a very honest movie in terms of like, it's exactly what a Vice magazine crew, a Vice documentary crew would do. They would find a weird cult in South America and start interviews.
Right. And it felt like a fresh POV, like a new take on it, even though I knew that's what I was watching. And sometimes I get so sick of them because I just watch so many of these like films, but this was one that it didn't bother me that this was POV. And I'd said, oh, I'm not sick of this. This is nice. This is great. Ty West has a little bit of help from a producer named Larry Fessender. I think I'm saying it right. I keep wanting to be. It looks like Fassbender. So, like, that's what I think it is. But this guy produced The Innkeepers, produced House of the Devil. And he ties in Jim Mickle, who people know from Mulberry Street, which is an excellent creature feature. And people probably know mostly from Stakeland.
Oh, okay. He produced that?
This Larry guy, yeah.
Okay.
Produce this. And so he's tied in my little chart that I keep referring to. He's tied into many people on my chart.
So Blumhouse Pictures, we know from their horror stuff, but they have a background with Ethan Hawke. They made the contemporary version of Hamlet, some HBO movies, the Darwin Awards, but Paranormal Activity is where they really made bank the first time around. Mm-hmm. This was a movie made on a micro budget, but when it hit the theaters, holy shit, like they surprised everybody.
Right.
And with the rights to the movie, they just kept pumping them out. Although I'll go so far just to say I love 2 and 3. 1 is a little slow, but I love 2 and 3.
Paranormal Activity 1 you don't like?
It's slow. I'm not really compelled.
I remember watching that in the theater, too. That's another one I remember absolutely. Yeah. And the girl who was watching it with me thought it was real.
Okay, sorry, but she's a dummy. Paranormal Activity 3, I saw in a downtown Brooklyn theater. And I'm not going to say it because it's a spoiler, but there is the audience gasp was so much fun to be in the presence of an actual theater and not just watch it at home because mm-hmm. it wasn't supposed to be hysterical, but it became hysterical after a while, trailing off. They also made Sinister. That was another Ethan Hawke one. They did The Purge. These guys specialize in these like tiny budget movies that wind up turning them a huge profit. Blumhouse. Oh, wow. They did Oculus. They yes, executive produced they Oculus, did. Which, all right, they're not all winners. But Oculus, written and directed by the same guy who did Absentia, which you loved.
So disappointing. I loved Absentia.
Yeah, that was a micro budget.
And I thought it was beautiful. It looked beautiful. The story was excellent.
Yeah.
And then they did Oculus, and I just don't even relate those two films.
Another one on the, like, faux documentary tip mm-hmm. that I loved and I thought it was really effective. We both love it. Yellow Brick Road.
Yes. And that was when I found, by just looking up, because I loved The Signal so much. Mm. So I started looking up the actors like I did with AJ Bowen. That's how I discovered all these other films. I looked up Inessa Ramsey because she was excellent in The Signal.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
She's the lead in The Signal. And I said, I saw that she had done this film. So I
that's,
said,
that's how you found it.
That's how I found it.
Okay. It had popped up on my Netflix streaming. You might like this one. And the cover is relatively generic. I think it's almost identical to like the REC series.
Yeah.
It's like being dragged into bushes. But I watched the trailer for it mm-hmm. and it looked compelling enough. And there are some moments in that movie that because you're in documentary mode, there's no separation. Like, I'm watching a movie. It's like, no, I'm watching horrible things happen right, to these people. Right.
It was excellent. Great use of music because the music is really the eerie. Point there.
Yeah. 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 To just encapsulate the movie, it's a documentary film crew who are investigating the story of a town that essentially picked up one day and marched off mm-hmm. into the mountains and were never heard from again. And when they sort of plan on following the trail, horrible things begin to happen. And I don't want to give any spoilers, but that one absolutely chased down.
Yeah, that one. And Inessa Ramsey is excellent actor.
Yeah, that was a fantastic cast. It wouldn't have worked if there was a weak link in it. Because mm-hmm. it would have stood out. But that one I really enjoyed.
So apart from this boys club of Wingard and Ty West and everyone, there's actually some women making films.
Are there?
There are, Darren.
They're not American, though.
No, they're not American.
They're Canadians.
They're Canadian.
And
it's
a twofer. They're twins.
Twins. Identical twin sisters that have started their own production company, Twisted Twins.
The Saska?
Saska Twins. Twins. Is who they are. I only know the one's name is Jen. Jen Saska.
Yeah, so they're a writing-directing duo.
So you'd know the Saska twins from American Mary. That's their only popular film. They show up now in the new ABCs of Death 2.
That's right. They did the audition? No, it wasn't called that.
I don't remember what the letter was because I honestly hated it.
Wait, no, porn. Something
It was
porn.
About torture porn.
Right. It was a
whatever.
Yes.
I think it was T. I gave it away. I don't care. Hate that movie. It was T for torture porn.
Okay. But American Mary holds up really well.
American Mary is great. They cast some of the most interesting looking people I've ever seen.
Yeah. They're very comfortable with oddity.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So so it's awesome to watch that. And that movie is so funny and it's so dark. And she's such a matter-of-fact kind of girl. And I really, really liked that, but I don't see it in any of their other films.
I'm curious what comes next from them.
Well, what's coming next, Darren, since you do say so, they're working on See No Evil 2 with Kane.
That's a weird move. Because, I mean, it's, if memory serves, that is a WWF picture.
Absolutely.
So going from an independent horror movie to working for like McMahon,
right?
In a wrestling inspired horror movie. I just, you know what?
I'll give the benefit of the doubt. I didn't mind the first one though.
No? I only saw the trailer.
Was that the one that Bubs was in from The Wire? It doesn't matter. Tangent.
He's got the throwing hook.
Yeah, and I loved
hook
it.
Hook on a chain.
You knew, and you were always like, who's going to get hooked next? And you know what I would have done? I would have put like a shield. I would have made a shield on my back and front. Like a cardboard sign man. They're going to live through that.
Okay. Maybe they figured that one out for the sequel. But who knows? Maybe they took the movie because they had a creative idea behind it. But we'll wait to see.
We'll see. We'll see. I'm not really looking forward to seeing future films from them. So we'll see. Mm-hmm. It's a shame because they're really the only women doing this.
Yeah, that's too bad. We talked about the Babadook in our very first episode. And she's an actress turned filmmaker. So mm-hmm. That's an interesting turn. But again, Australian. Like, where are the American women making scary movies?
There's not a lot of them doing it.
And which is surprising considering like, you could bring in, like, scary movies, you get mostly guy fans, let's be honest. Like,
I don't know. I think that, you know, I think you'd be surprised at conventions, at horror cons and stuff.
I would be surprised.
I think there's a lot of women that like film, you know, but for me, as a woman who likes horror film, I don't care if it's done by a woman. I don't care that a woman made it.
So what I was going to say is that the sensibility that they're speaking to, like, it's clearly not being represented.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're missing out because there are stories to be told that wouldn't have occurred to dudes.
Right.
And so that's a little bit frustrating that you kind of wish, you know, you did get to hear some of those stories.
Sure.
Because woman's experience present day is so vast. I mean, if you spend any time on the internet, you know that women are living an incredibly different life than your average dude.
I mean, the best you can do is watch American Mary and enjoy that, but pretty much that's where that ends.
So that's it for us on indie horror. Look for us at Rant Macabre on Twitter and also find us on iTunes and Stitcher and give us a review. It's really useful for us to gain followers and pass around the podcast. I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy. See you next week.